Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books podcast. This week we're joined by the poet Patricia Lockwood, whose account of moving back in with her parents in her 20s, Priest Daddy, offers a hilarious portrait of a mother living in terror of global implosion and a father who's a gun-toting, guitar-playing Catholic priest. Along with the humour, there's also explicit language and upsetting themes. So, Sian, why did you want to get her into the studio?
For the explicit language and upsetting themes, mainly. No, she's really fun. She's very famous in a weird way on Twitter because she's part of the weird Twitter movement, which is basically the art of crafting a strange standalone joke that kind of works on its own for its strangeness.
In 140 characters.
Yeah. And because she's a poet, she kind of lends herself to that, and she got a big following, and then she's written a couple of poems that have become very famous. And she's kind of well known for being slightly smutty.
It was the smut that did it.
Yeah. She's just really fun and fresh and challenging, and often her poems are really uncomfortable. But then there's something interesting about being made uncomfortable by her poems. I mean, to talk about being made uncomfortable by a poem, she's read a poem for us on this podcast called "The Whole World Gets Together and Gangbangs a Deer."
Should we hear a bit of that now?
Yep.
The whole world gets together and gangbangs a deer. Bambi is fresh from the countryside. Bambi is fresh, and we want him on film. He doesn't even know how to kiss yet. Lean in and part your lips, we say, and pull a slow strip off a tree. We shine our biggest spotlight on him. Our biggest spotlight is the sun. And under the spotlight, the deer drips sweat. And what do deer like more than salt? Now look at the fawn and grow an antler, we patiently instruct him. It will grow from your thoughts like the ones on your head. Oh, Bambi, says the fawn. Oh, Bambi. Fresh grass stains around the young mouth. Every deer gets called Bambi at least once in its life. Every deer must answer to Bambi. Every deer hears "Don't kill Bambi." Every deer hears "Don't eat Bambi." Every deer hears "Look, oh look, it's Bambi." When the deer all die, they will die of genericide, of one baby name for the million of them. Then women begin to be called Bambi, and then deer understand what women are like. Light shafts of long blonde hair and long legs. The sun piercing through the Bavarian trees. And the sun touching down on the dewy green ground. Then women begin to be called fawn, and then women begin to say, "Bambi, oh, Bambi." And their mouths are open, and they gape like a mouth when it takes a big bite of spring green. The spotlight shines down through the trees in long legs. This is the first movie most of us see. Small name for a small deer, Bambi. Sometimes he feels all the deer could fit inside him. The movie we are making is this one. All the deer and one deer, one after another. Subtitles, so we know what his soft sounds are saying. Mostly he says, "The meadow, the meadow." Like the women who are Bambi say, "God, oh God." What they mean is a wide open space, a great clearing. All the deer and us watching in a great open field. A great wide clearing in the face of the deer says, "The meadow, the meadow." And all of us watching. The deer's mouths moving as if they are reading. But no, they are eating the grass.
When she came into the studio, she began by reading a little from the memoir.
My mother attended church every Sunday, which my father thought was just so damn hilarious. He was not going to be shut up in small spaces and forced to do tricks on command. Instead, he joined the Navy and plunged into the ocean in that smallest and most obedient space of all, a nuclear submarine called the USS Flying Fish. And it was here, in the middle of perfect claustrophobia, that a moment of his life split open and spilled the nuclear green glow of infinity all over him. And became his origin story. It occurred during a late-night viewing of The Exorcist. The room was dark, and that eerie pea-soup light was pouring down. And all around him, men in sailor suits were getting the bejesus scared out of them, and the bejesus flew into my father like a dart into a bullseye. He saw the little girl's head spin around to consider the hidden half of things, and his head spun around likewise. Over the course of that patrol, the men watched The Exorcist 72 times, and on the very next patrol, my father converted. Put yourself in his place. You're a drop of blood at the center of the ocean, which plays a tense soundtrack all night long, interspersed with bright blips of radar. Russians are trying to blow up capitalism, and you're surrounded by dolphins who know how to spy, and the general atmosphere is one of cinematic suspense. All of a sudden, you look up at a screen and see a possessed 12-year-old with violent bedhead vomiting green chunks in backwards Latin. She's so full of a demon that the only way to relieve her feelings is to have hate sex with a crucifix. You would convert too, I guarantee it.
Patricia, welcome to the Guardian Books podcast.
Thank you.
I think we should start with your father because a lot of the book revolves around him. It's called Priest Daddy. But your father is a Catholic priest, which I didn't realize was even a thing that was possible.
Most people don't. You would tell them that and they would tell you that you were lying because it's just like outside of the realm of conception, because the one thing we know about Catholic priests is that they do not get to have sex ever until they die, and then they go to heaven, and they also can't have sex there.
So what happened? I mean, because in your reading, you're describing your father becoming a Lutheran, and then there's a little progression. I didn't realize there was a loophole into Catholicism.
I know. It was almost like it was planned from the very beginning. He was like a rock and roll atheist, and then he joined the Navy. And he had a conversion because they watched The Exorcist 72 times, you know, on board the submarine, like miles under the surface of the sea. And so as soon as he got out of the Navy, he studied to become a Lutheran minister. And then he's like, well, that's not extreme enough for me. I want to be a Catholic. So then he converts to Catholicism. And he's like, well, guess what? I'm going to be a priest in this religion, too. Yeah, so there is a loophole that if you are a married minister of another faith who converts, you can have the option to apply for a dispensation to Rome and become a married Catholic priest.
And you have to do the psychopath test.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't know if that's across the board, but apparently we all had to do it.
Really?
Yeah, my mom must have flunked. Now, but see, and again, in the book, I address the question. I'm like, there's no way my dad could have passed this test. You look at the questions, and it's like, there's no way. He gets an F. But apparently, you know, there was no problem at all.
Didn't he flunk it on purpose at one point?
He flunked it on purpose at first because he was like, oh, I just felt like they were messing with me, like trying to mess me up and get in my head. So I answered every question wrong on purpose. And it came back that I was completely a psychopath. And I was like, you are a psychopath. Only a psychopath would do that, dude. Like, that's the whole thing. But then I was like, so you took it again? He said, yeah. And then I just took it normally and it was fine.
I mean, so the book is hinged around the event that your husband, Jason, has a very expensive medical bill, and you move back in with your parents when you're both adults while you sort of save some money.
It happens in America. Yeah. You know, fairly frequently that sort of thing happens. Yeah.
Well, I suppose it is kind of uniquely American in that way.
Yeah.
But then with all the kindness and goodwill in the world, your parents are eccentric, it's fair to say.
I would say even eccentric in the English sense. Yeah. Like, you look around and I'm like, my dad is not like other Americans. There is something special going on here. And I think maybe the only ones with the capacity to understand it perhaps are, like, the British. That long storied history of eccentricity here.
Can you sort of describe for people that haven't read the book, that haven't been introduced to your father, what are some of the things that make him him?
Well, he's nearly nude all the time. So he wears he doesn't wear any trousers. He just wears these, you know, see-through little white pants. I assume that's what what you call them. Yeah, his little knickers. Yeah. So he just wears those, and he's usually got an electric guitar in one hand, and, you know, over on the table there's some sort of gun that he's dissembling or cleaning in some way. And he's, like, blasting ass rock in any given moment. And yet at the same time, you know, he gets up, he puts on a cassock, he puts away the electric guitar and goes over and says mass next door. So it's like an extreme contrast.
So was there, when you moved back in with your parents, you obviously had the experience of your childhood with them. Moving back in with them, was there any part of you when you first went back into that house going, I should perhaps mine this life event for something for a book?
No, I didn't think of that at all. I mostly just wanted to die because I was moving back in with my parents, so I wasn't thinking about art at all. And in fact, it's my family is never really something I wanted to particularly write about. But after, I would say, it was soon, it was maybe even a couple of weeks, I just noticed that I was writing down everything they said because I didn't want to miss out on their quotes. And it was a pleasant distraction, I will say, from all the ass rock and prog rock that he was playing. So I just went with it at that point.
Yeah. Well, there's a lovely bit of teamwork between you and Jason where yes. he starts collecting bits. You sort of signal. I think there's one bit with you're telling a seminarian about what a MILF is,
yes.
which is a wonderful sentence
yes.
to say.
And
you signaled to Jason to write it all down.
I got in trouble for that.
Really?
Yeah, so on my Amazon page in America, it said something about, the summary said something about my sexual education of the seminarian.
Oh, wow.
And so I got a call from my dad where he's like, the vicar general just got in touch with me and we need you to take that sentence off the Amazon page because it sounds like you taught the seminarian about sex by having sex with him. And I was like, No. And I wrote my editor and I was like, please take this off because I don't want to be in a situation again where I'm having to talk to frickin' vicar generals, whatever the hell that is. Like, I don't want to be back in my childhood where I have to answer to these people again, right? So just take that sentence off.
So in terms of how you gathered everything, I mean, Jason was writing some things down and mm-hmm. I think he delivered a napkin to you at one point
yes.
with some excellence that your mother came
out
with.
Because I never ate breakfast and
right.
he would always eat breakfast with her, which was very sweet, and they would go have these very healthy like egg white omelets together, and my mother would progressively become more insane as she drank more caffeine, and so by the end of breakfast she was like really producing some rapid fire good quotes, which I was always missing out on. So he would come back and he has a little napkin that says something like, did you know that rats in big cities are getting aggressive from eating too many cigarette butts? They're addicted to nicotine and they want more. And it's like, thank you, Jason. That is going to be useful for my work. Yes.
It's a very funny book, but it's also about religion.
Yes.
And that must be a very tricky line to tread for people that
yeah.
tend to be sensitive about these things. And you talk about the language you use and you say that you've been accused of blasphemy before, mm-hmm. but then you say it's my way of still participating mm-hmm. in the language I was raised inside.
Yeah.
You must, as a poet, there must be a certain amount of appreciation for the language of religion. And
yes,
sort of,
absolutely. It's yeah. very grand, and it's a very long tradition of sort of thinking and incantation and poetry. And you would be a fool to just throw all that away. I mean, you can't do that. But it's also true that, you know, when I'm making these blasphemous jokes, it feels very intimate to me, you know, because that's what I grew up with. It's what I thought about all the time. So those jokes to me are actually like very close. It's sort of like a glimpse inside my mind. It's not me attempting to be disrespectful, but it's like a look at the way I think.
And as a poet, are there particular phrases or words that you've heard come out just from conversation with seminarians around the house or anything like that, that you go, that's a beautiful turn of phrase? Or...
Yeah, and it's, you know, they use language in a different way, and there will be certain words that you'll use, like in the Catholic tradition, sort of like words like revelation and that sort of thing that means something different to us. And it felt, being back in that house, like hearing the seminary and hearing my father, like I was being returned to that very oldest, earliest sense of language that I had, because they were talking in exactly the same way. It doesn't ever change, really.
And you are a poet, first and foremost.
Yeah, I would say so.
And a lot of your poetry does deal with sex and deals
yeah.
with sexual imagery and stuff. I was wondering, does any of that sort of Catholic prurience sort of feed into that, the sexual element in your poetry?
Oh, yeah. Catholics are very sexy because, again, like, we're just constantly, like, we literally worship in a church where there's a nude guy hanging out just at the front of the church and there's nothing else to even look at. So yeah, we're gonna be thinking about that like all the time. I'm always shocked when people find it surprising. Like, to me, this is like very Catholic poetry, you know, like I'm treating the body sort of like in both a physical and sort of ecstatic terms. You know, you're thinking about it on existing on both planes, and that's extremely Catholic.
And there is a chapter in your memoir where you talk about the publication of the poem Rape Joke,
mm-hmm.
and which was published in 2013, and it was published online, wasn't it?
Yes,
right?
It was published in The All originally, yeah.
And there was a big conversation that started around it. I hate using the word viral, but it went viral.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really interesting to read in this book because I remember when that poem came
yeah.
out and everyone was talking about it, to actually read how you were feeling
yes,
on the other side of it, because
right.
you were getting contacted about
yes,
it, weren't you?
And I was living with my parents.
Yeah.
So I just want you to think about how weird that is. If you've ever had anything sort of like spread virally across the internet, you know that you're just like dealing with this constant deluge of messages and sort of like updates and like notifications all the time. And at the same time, in the next room, you know, like my dad and the seminarian are trying trying on dresses, you know, and like seeing which one has the most gold on it. So it was very dislocating because you're thinking about this going on, you know, and it's obviously very serious, and your mother's in the next room like reading it on Facebook. So it was an extremely unique experience, I would say, to have that happen literally like when I had been returned to my family home. It felt like the second or perhaps the closing act of something.
Mm. Just for someone that hasn't read the poem, just what was the poem about? Could you sort of just sum up for someone that hasn't possibly read it?
Well, it was sort of repeating. So there was obviously a conversation at the time about whether or not comedians should tell rape jokes, basically, which is, they've been a staple of comedy for a while. And, you know, I don't think that it's true that there can never be a funny one. Mm. But I don't think that it's ever true that there's going to be a joke where someone gets raped and it's funny, right? Mm. So I was thinking just specifically about the phrase rape joke, which has a very hard, brutal sound. And so I started thinking about this particular event in my life, and the poem just sort of followed from that, and sort of each line begins, you know, the rape joke is that you were 19 years old, the rape joke is that he was your boyfriend, and it just continues that way, sort of as a lyric essay, but it really wasn't like anything I'd written before formally. It was different.
And in terms of your mother reading it, because you say in the memoir you go down and your mother's reading it, she's crying. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a really interesting moment there, and my stomach just twisted up a bit when I read it, about the conversation you can overhear in the next room with your father and the seminarian. Can you just sort of talk about that moment for a bit? Because it's quite a moment.
Yeah. So, and this would be happening all the time. So I was sitting, you know, with my mother, and my mother is wearing her like craziest danger face pretty much because she's just read the poem. So her eyes are like, you know, basically in orbit. They look like the planet Saturn. And in the next room, I can hear my father and the seminarian talking about the case of some particular priest, I think in the St. Louis Archdiocese, who had like forced a girl into his car and kissed her in the parking lot of the cathedral. It was this very like Baroque detail that it was in the parking lot of the cathedral. And then I just hear a voice, and I don't know whose it was, saying, you know, well, she shouldn't have put him in that position. And we're talking about like a teen girl, and we're talking about a priest who's in this position of power. And it just returned me again to sort of like what it was like in my home hearing about these stories and our instant sort of instinct to protect these priests, to protect these guys in power.
You do talk about that, and it's really interesting about that instant need to ensure silence about these things, because you're talking about the Bishop Finn, I think it is.
Yeah, Bishop Robert.
Who at the time was still working in the church and now has since been asked
to
resign.
He had sheltered a priest who was known to be, you know, to I think have like child pornography on his computer and to have interacted with kids in an inappropriate way. As we say, like euphemistically, right?
Well, you're removed from the church in that you're not Catholic, but in terms of that instinct, is when you first realized that you had that instinct to protect something, is that...
Well, I think clearly everyone does. I don't think it's unique to Catholics at all. Like, we see it happen in colleges. You know, we saw something, like, happen at Penn State. And a lot of times, and these are people who are parents, they have kids, they ought to be, like, empathetic or sympathetic toward the victims in the situation, the first thought is there must be some excuse, there must be some reason he didn't do this. You want to... I think it has to do with wanting to arrange in your own mind the elements of the world so that they fit like a picture that makes sense to you. You know, to suddenly know that about, say, a priest in your parish is to have to rearrange like all the building blocks of your reality. And that's really difficult for people to do initially at first.
I mean, and so many of the conversations in the book and so much of the interesting dynamic between you and your parents is that you are removed from the church and you are a feminist and you're pro-choice, and there's all these elements to you that seem almost in direct conflict with things that they're going around talking about every day.
Oh, 100%, yes.
Is it a process of reconciliation and sort of looking at your parents and going, well, I love these people and I, you know, this is something they believe, but also I believe exactly the opposite?
Yeah. I mean, the sphere of their belief is so fixed and so strong that it's almost like, you know, my father talks to everyone as if they are Catholic. So he would call Jason, my husband, who was raised Baptist, who's not anything, he would call him into his room and be like, Jay, get in here. Did you read this
blog post of the bishop in Omaha or something. That's totally made up, by the way. It's just, you know, some random thing like that. He's like, he really went in on these modern swimsuits, Jay. And it's like he expected everyone in the world to have read this very specific niche sort of like Catholic blog post. So it's not even something you can quarrel with. It's not, you can't be like, well, not everyone is a cat. It's so basic that you it would literally entail me going in there being like, not everybody's a Catholic, guys. You know, it's talked about as if it's the thing that's foremost on everyone's minds at every single moment. So it's almost better to just sit back and let it wash over you. Yeah, I don't know how those conversations would actually look, but it would be like people speaking two different languages to each other, you know, trying to hash out some very important, like, moral or ethical, philosophical difference. I don't know that it would be possible.
Well, because I was raised in an atheist household, so I'm just naturally
atheist.
Yeah, I
can't even imagine what that's like.
It's always just a sort of looking at religion with kind of a, okay, that's a thing that happens.
It's a thing that happens, right. Whereas when we thought about atheists in my family growing up, it was always positioned in terms of like, they're atheists because they're mad at God, and eventually one day they'll see the error of their ways and they'll return to the church as if they began in it, which, you know, most people don't. So it wasn't even, it was almost like we didn't think it through, like the reality of a situation like that at all.
Well, what you're sort of coming out to your father as a sort of someone that wasn't Catholic, was it so devastating? And I think you were like 12 or 13. How old were you when you said to him, basically, he
this
said...
This is my husband.
It was your husband.
You're thinking of Jason.
Oh, yeah, I thought it was, you were telling Jason about the story where you said...
No,
everyone dies.
He was telling that to me, actually. Ah. And my husband is very interesting to me for this reason, because he was a guy who was just told his parents one day, I'm not going to church. And that, it was completely unthinkable in my family. Mm. It's just not something that would have happened at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I never had a conversation like that with my family.
Well, I was wondering about also, because your siblings as well, because you've got, you're one
there
of five.
Five of us, right? Yeah.
So I know for a fact, just sort of from having read the book, that at least one of your sister is still practicing Catholic.
Yeah, it's quite Catholic, yeah. I would say like an extreme traditional Catholic, yeah.
Mm. What are the other siblings like in terms of what's their relationship with religion?
I would say that they're culturally Catholic for the most part. Like my sister Mary, who's a pharmacist, she goes to church. You know, I think that she still considers herself a Catholic. My brother Paul, who is in the military, I think he's culturally Catholic probably. Probably my little brother Daniel is the closest to me in terms of just like, oh, okay.
And in terms of your, now the book is out, you said you're...
Soon to be, very soon to be out, yes.
I mean, has your, you said your father doesn't read your poetry because there's no submarines in them.
Yeah, I mean, there's not, and I got really nervous last night because I was telling that anecdote because people always ask me, they're like, has your father read it? And I'm like, no.
Yeah.
You know, like there's no submarines in it. But then I was thinking about it and I was like, actually, there are lots of submarines in my book.
There's a lot of references to him liking
submarines.
Totally,
yeah. So I was like, this is fair game for my dad to read. He actually could read this book. I don't think that he will.
No.
Has
anyone in the family read it?
Yes. My three younger siblings have. Okay. And my mom, I've read out loud to her certain parts that she has found extremely funny. And sometimes, like, I've fixed something or I've, like, made it a little bit slicker or something like that, and I'll read it to her and she's like, oh, I did say that. I'm like, you did, girl. Yeah, you did.
Well, I suppose then talking to other people about the book, do you get constantly people going, well, I know a Greg Lockwood. I've got my own sort of eccentric family member.
Actually, no. I mostly get people disbelieving that he's like that at all. And I was talking to an interviewer the other day, and she's like, so, I mean, how would you describe him? And I'm like, you know, Toad of Toad Hall. I'm like, it's basically, it's like that as a guy, like a human man who's kind of like, oh, Modica, you know, like, ah, my big grand house. Kind of like a manic, but sort of like a generous personality that at the same time is like easily wounded, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so when I read Wind in the Willows, I'm like, damn. Toad's my dad, man.
So the general attitude is that he's too weird to make up.
Yeah, no. And I'm like, this is not an American thing. So talking to people over here, I'm like, there are not a lot of Americans like this, you know. I don't know what it is. He honestly is hatched out of his own egg. I've never met a person like him. And I feel in the book that I was able to describe him in some small portion. But you would have to meet him. I don't know that it's possible to really put him fully fleshed on the page.
Will you keep trying to put your family on the page, or is this sort of, you feel like you're done with your family?
I'm like, that was my first try. Yeah. It was good enough.
Patricia Lockwood got us all thinking about funny memoirs, so Sian's here in the studio along with Lindsay Irvin to guide us through the vein of humour running through life writing. But perhaps we should start by differentiating between memoirs from civilians and books published by comedy professionals.
Yeah, well, one of the best by a stand-up, like a proper comedian, I think, is Steve Martin's Born Standing Up, which is actually all about why he left stand-up and sort of what was going on in his life at the time. And it's just beautiful. He's actually got a very lovely voice in writing, and it's a very, very good memoir. And also Tina Fey's Bossy Pants, which I would say actually is one to get on audiobook rather than as a book.
Just, and it's her on the audiobook.
That's
audiobook,
quite
is
often
it?
The case, isn't it?
Yeah.
The audiobook for a comedian's audiobook works better.
Yeah, just because like if you're aware of these people like Tina Fey and you know her voice, then it does come through on the page, but it's actually very enjoyable to have her delivery as well. And that's quite a great book, sort of talking about her work in SNL and her career and stuff, but also just talking about her thoughts about sort of different things happening in the world. And yeah, it's a very, very nice book.
But no plan to leave stand-up comedy behind?
No, so. No. She had a better experience. And I suppose, like, because she's not really a stand-up comic. She's sort of just a comedian, really. But then that's the funny thing with a lot of these memoirs that are humorous. You have people who are comedians. You have people who are memoirists who happen to be funny. And then you have people who are humorists, like David Sedaris, I suppose, who isn't really a comic, but he's very well known as a comic writer.
And what is it about his writing that's so very funny?
I think it's his ability to transform something that's very mundane and suburban and silly, and like his experience moving house is one of his pieces in, I think, in Me Talk Pretty One Day. He talks about moving house and just what happens on that day. And it's hilarious, and you can sort of relate on one aspect in that everyone's moved house, but you know, just to marvel at how witty he can be about that is really wonderful.
I guess that eye for the humorous detail is something that Sedaris shares with those writers who aren't professional comedians but wind up producing memoirs that are full of laughter.
And I suppose happen to have an ear for the, or an eye for the piquant detail that stands out at the right moment to poke your funny bone. And I think of particularly immediately of Martin Amis's memoir Experience, which isn't, there's lots of stuff that is not comic in that memoir, but because of his skill as a comedian and also the fact that it's very much a tribute to his father, Kingsley Amis, who was very funny, there are some great details. I mean, there's a fantastic reported gag about his father, Kingsley Amis, seeing a dog getting a very overheated and bad-tempered on a hot day sitting on top of the metal roof of a car, and him explaining to Martin how he walked past it, and the dog just turns to him and looks up and says, "Fuck off."
But I mean, you also bring up, there's quite a lot about his family in there, isn't there?
Yes. I mean, I think that's probably a common theme to the overwhelming majority of memoirs, is that an awful lot of people just seeking to reckon with their background, their family, and particularly their parents very often trying to sort of square their position.
And so if you're going to write a memoir with some humour, then I guess you need the material.
Yes, and some very good writers that I can think of do that. I'm thinking in particular of Gary Steingart in recent years, who has a luminously neurotic and eccentric family who were transplanted from Russia towards the end of state communism to Brooklyn, and who are unashamedly disparaging and neurotic about their neurotic but very brilliant son Gary.
I suppose we should probably say that he portrays them as being neurotic.
We take it on trust that yeah, it's probably true. And presumably I think they take issue with stuff he's written. There's some nice material about his mother and his father, I think, just grouching about the fact that how come you're only the 37th, the New Yorker's 37th best writer in the US? What's gone wrong? And the memoir's called Little Failure, which I think is how they refer to him. Another family, yet more neurotic and even psychotic, really, is Shalom Auslanders, who is a writer who grew up in an ultra super duper orthodox community in upstate New York, and grew to have the hatred described within the family is quite hysterical. The daughter hates the mother, the brother hates the sister, they all hate him.
But hysterical in a way that makes us laugh.
And hysterical in a way that makes us laugh. I mean, he's great on what a dick God is, as he describes it to them. It's black stuff, but it is, if you've got that kind of edge of, if that neurotic hysteria appeals to you, you will laugh quite a lot.
I mean, that sounds kind of straightforwardly dysfunctional.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's also Augustine Burroughs, who there tends to be a little bit more. There's quite a lot of tragedy in his book Running with Scissors, which is about a very dysfunctional family, but dysfunctional in that his mother has psychotic episodes and decides to give her son to her psychiatrist's family to raise. Ooh. And and it goes exactly as well as you think. I mean, there's this situation, a really horrible situation, where he's this young kid, he's about 13, he thinks he's gay, and he comes out to the psychiatrist's adopted son. The adopted son is in his 30s, and they start having a sexual relationship, but then Augustine starts sort of having obviously quite a traumatized reaction to it, and veers between demanding affection from this man, but also trying to sort of use their relationship as blackmail fodder.
And this doesn't turn into just an account of woe and misery.
It's really funny. And that's the thing. It's like, how the hell do you make that funny? And it's really, really good. And I think it's just that it must just passage of time, I suppose, that after a bit of space and a bit of time, he's been able to put all his wit into it and translate it a bit. And it's a very, very, very good memoir.
But it's not all about kind of woe and distress and family dysfunction.
Well, yeah, I mean, so much of these, I'm sort of realising, hearing our lists, that it's all about dysfunctional families. And I wonder what it says about us. But, I mean, there's someone who I do love who didn't really have dysfunctional family. She had a wacky family. Her name's Jenny Lawson, and people may know her because she has a website called The Bloggess. And she's a bit like Patricia Lockwood in a way, in that she sort of built her career online, didn't really have an experience writing for anywhere, but she wrote a really good memoir called Let's Pretend This Never Happened. And that's about her growing up in rural Texas. And it's just, you know, her father's a taxidermist, which lends itself to a sort of wacky upbringing. You know, they have a pig farm.
A certain amount of black humour there.
Yeah, yeah. It's not like, you know, child abuse, but it's, you know, it's just a strange childhood. But it's a really, really good book, and she's just got a lovely voice, just like Patricia.
Well, we'll put a list of all those books up on the website, on the podcast page. Thanks to you both, and thanks also to Patricia Lockwood, whose memoir is published by Allen Lane. Her collection of poetry, Motherland, Fatherland, Homeland Sexuals, is published by Penguin.
And as always, we're exploring the wonderful archives of the Global Development Podcast made here at The Guardian. They made an extraordinary podcast some months ago about the Colombian city of women. Set up in 1999 on the outskirts of Cartagena by a lawyer called Patricia Guerrero, the new city was built to support the many women severely affected by the country's many years of conflict, suffering forced displacement from their homes, sexual violence, and the murder of their families. The podcast is an incredible insight into those brilliant women and how they built up a city of hope around them. To have a listen, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Which is where, of course, you'll find us too. Just spark up your favourite podcast app and search for Guardian Books Podcast. And you can join in the conversation as well, either by commenting on the Guardian website or at Guardian Books on Twitter.
And on that note, this week we published a story looking at whether there is a gender gap in publishing. If you haven't had a read yet, head to the site and have a look. And if you've ever worked in publishing and have any experiences or observations to share, please send them to us using the form we have on the site.
But for now, for me, Richard Lee.
And me, Sean Kane.
And me, Lindsay Irvin.
And our silent producer, Susanna Tresillian. Goodbye and thanks for listening.